So without further ado, let's bring up Mr. Alex Zek. Alex Zek, ladies and gentlemen. Woo-hoo!
All right. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you, John. Thank you, Derek, for inviting me. Hopefully this presentation won't ruffle too many feathers. Okay, can you guys, yeah, you can see this. Cool. Okay. So I like to start this presentation by giving five data points, and these data points are coming from straight from the CDC. This one you see is one of those data points. Over 75% of COVID deaths were in people age 65 and up. Over 50% of COVID deaths were in people age 75 and up. 95% of COVID deaths had an average of 4 comorbidities, most being lifestyle and nutrition related. 79% of hospitalizations were in overweight or obese people. And then this study was published July of 2021 by the CDC. And it showed that the second strongest risk factor for death associated with COVID was fear / anxiety related disorders. Have you guys heard that before? Okay. So this led me to sort of ask myself about the impact of belief on our biology. What happens when we're conditioned to believe in something that may not even exist? What happens when we're conditioned to believe in something that is pathogenic and potentially deadly, something that could be anywhere but is invisible to the naked eye? In this presentation, I'll attempt to answer the following things. Are we sure that viruses exist, or is it a conditioned belief? Could the supposed effects of viruses be caused by something else? What causes the contagion phenomenon, or two or more people getting sick in the same space? Are temporary symptoms of illness bad, or is this a conditioned belief as well? And why is this important? Okay, I'd like to start with a thought experiment. Does Santa Claus exist? Rhetorical question, right? But from a kid's perspective, right, all of the cartoons, all of the songs that we've seen, the pieces of beard found in the fireplace, the half-eaten cookies and milk, the reindeer tracks on my front lawn, the music, the Santa Claus sleigh tracking app, or the Santa Claus thing that they're doing on NBC or on Fox News following Santa's trajectory across the sky, all of this evidence in my environment points to Santa Claus existing. What do you mean, Mom and Dad, Santa Claus doesn't exist? You made me feel fear when you told me that Santa was going to bring me lumps of coal if I didn't behave correctly. I had a measurable and observable biological response to Santa Claus, and you're telling me he doesn't exist? Right? Here's another analogy, and this comes from Dr. Tom Cowan's book, The Contagion Myth. Essentially, if I were to tell you that a ping pong ball could break down a brick wall, of course you'd call me crazy at first, but then you'd be like, well, show me that I could break down a brick wall. And I said, okay, I'll do it. So I take some corrosive acid and pour it all over a brick wall. I take a giant mallet and smash a brick wall several times. And then I tape a ping pong ball to a giant boulder, attach it to a crane and hurl it at the brick wall, and the brick wall falls down. Have I proven that the ping pong ball caused the destruction of that brick wall? Yeah, you said yeah, no. And of course not, right? Okay, so how does this relate to virology? This is how it does. So if I were to tell you, and you hadn't heard this before because some of you have probably heard this by now, if I were to tell you that SARS-CoV-2 or insert any other virus has not been isolated or proven to exist or to cause disease, right, you would likely go on Google Scholar or PubMed, find a number of studies, peer-reviewed studies, that, like this one, isolation characterization of SARS-CoV-2 from the first U.S. COVID-19 patient, you'd send it to me, you'd say there's thousands of these, Alec, you're crazy, and then you'd dismiss everything that I say thereafter, right? Here's the problem. This is what virtually everyone in society aside from virologists, knows isolation to mean. That's to separate from another substance so as to obtain in a pure or free state. Now, this is the methods section of that same paper, and on the following slide, I'm going to break down what is highlighted in yellow. Methods section is essentially their procedure for the experiment. So first, they take fluids from a sick patient that they assume contains a virus. They then add that to viral transport medium. Viral transport medium contains at the least gentamicin and amphotericin. They then add those fluids alongside viral transport medium to a VIRO-E6 or a VIRO-CCL81 cell culture, which is a cell line coming from an adult green monkey. Alongside this mixture of viral transport medium and snot from a sick person, they add Delbecco's minimal essential medium trypsin, gentamicin, amphotericin B, penicillin, streptomycin, fetal bovine serum. And then the cell breaks down, experiencing what is called the cytopathic effect. The sample is then collected and prepared for electron microscopy. And then they produce electron micrograph images, point to the particles on the images, and say that those are viruses. Has anyone heard that before, by the way? Okay, there's a good number of people in here. That's good. Okay, so there are three major branches of science, and right now what we're talking about is natural science. I'll skip over this, formal science, social science. John, I promise I'll only go 40 minutes on this. So natural science is the study of natural phenomena. Natural science tries to explain and predict nature's phenomena based on empirical evidence. In natural science, a hypothesis must be verified scientifically to be regarded as a scientific theory. Scientific method, I think everyone knows this. We all learned this in grade school, right? This may seem like I'm sort of beating a dead horse, but this is important because I'm going to show how virology does not adhere to the scientific method. Okay, so the steps of the scientific method are as follows. You have a natural phenomenon that you're observing, and then you formulate a hypothesis. Essentially, it's this. I observe Y phenomenon occurring, right, and happening to or inside of Z. I think X causes Y to happen to or inside of Z. I then take X, which is my independent variable, and expose it to Z in a controlled environment to see if it produces the observed phenomenon or the dependent variable Y, right? Did Y occur? Did the observed phenomenon occur in that situation? If yes, I validate my hypothesis. If no, I've invalidated my hypothesis. In order to observe a natural phenomenon, that implies that it is not manipulated or controlled by the investigator, and it is not initiated by the investigator. So for the sake of the example I'm using, right, you may observe multiple people in the same space getting sick with the same or similar symptoms, right? That's an observed phenomenon that is not initiated by the investigator. Maybe you could argue that the overlords up top, the wild gang of nefarious actors running the world, is manipulating it, but okay, then you have a hypothesis, a proposed explanation for the phenomenon. I know this seems dry, but I'm getting somewhere with this, you guys. Okay, so your hypothesis may be, I think a particle in the fluids of these people is causing them to become sick, right? That's your hypothesis. You think that this particle or these particles are causing people to become sick. In order to proceed with experimentation, you need to have your presumed cause, the independent variable, completely by itself to vary and manipulate. You need to show that it actually exists in nature in order to proceed with experimentation. And the problem is, with our example, virology, the virus has not first been shown to exist in nature. They assume that there is a virus inside the fluids of a sick person, that they're then adding to a foreign cell culture, a VRO-E6 or a VRCCL81 cell culture, alongside cytotoxic antibiotics and antimycotics, which I'll get into in a second. They assume that the virus is producing the cytopathic effect, which is essentially just the cell breaking down into a bunch of fragments. They assume those other things that are added don't have an impact on the culture. Again, I'll get into those in just a second. The culturing process itself is completely unnatural. There are no proper control experiments, and I want to emphasize for those who've done a bit of research on this, a lot of virologists will refer to a mock-infected culture, but they won't describe what goes into the mock-infected culture, or they will treat the mock infection with different antibiotics, different levels, different amounts, different types of antibiotics and antimycotics, so it's not a proper control experiment. So virology does not adhere to this scientific method. Again, your presumed cause, the independent variable, the thing that you think is creating this phenomenon that you're observing, people getting sick, you have to have it by itself to vary and manipulate in order to even begin experimentation. And virology has never done this as a body of so-called science. These little electron micrograph images that we see, like that one of a supposed SARS-CoV-2 virion, always come from the experiment that I just described, where they assume all of these things, they mix all of this stuff in a cell culture, and then it produces an effect, and they say, it must have been caused by a virus. So pseudoscience consists of statements, beliefs, or practices that claim to be both scientific and factual, but are incompatible with the scientific method. Is virology a science? No, it can't possibly be, because in order to be scientific, and again, I have to preface this by saying you have to claim to be scientific and adhere to the scientific method in order to be regarded as scientific. If you're not making what you're calling a scientific claim, then it doesn't matter. But they're claiming virology is a real science, but they are not adhering to the scientific method. That is pseudoscience. Scientific theory is an explanation of an aspect of the natural world and universe that has been repeatedly tested and corroborated in accordance with the scientific method. So is the germ theory even a proper theory? And again, this extends into bacteria too. Bacteria, they have never taken in an isolated, purified form and exposed to a healthy person to cause symptoms of disease. They have not followed the scientific method in that way either. So the germ theory itself is not even a proper scientific theory. They're still at germ hypothesis. You guys following along so far? Okay. You guys like this so far? Okay. Okay. Can we do a scientific experiment on Santa Claus? No. Okay. Good. We're on the same page. I had someone at another presentation say yes, and I was like, okay, I got to go back like 100 slides. Okay. I mean, you can see measurable and observable effects on children at the idea of Santa Claus, at the belief in Santa Claus, right? It's the same thing with this. Okay, and this is why viruses cannot be isolated, purified, characterized, and sequenced directly from the fluids of a sick person, according to experts, right? They'll say that the virus is too weak, and these are actually responses that I've received and other of my friends and colleagues have received. The virus is too weak to isolate or purify directly from the fluids. Okay, they'll say that on one hand. On the other hand, they'll say that a virus travels freely through the air, lands on a surface, survives on a surface for upwards of 2 to 3 days, makes it all the way to a body, breaks into a cell, hijacks the cell's machinery, begins a replication process that overwhelms the body, is excreted out of that person where it does the same thing over again. So it's too weak to isolate or purify directly from the fluids, but it does all of those things, right? And also, this is a reification fallacy, these first three are, and I'll get into that in a minute. There's not enough virus present in the fluids to isolate or purify it. If you talk to any chemist, they're isolating particles much smaller than viruses are purported to be all the time and purifying them. So this argument that there's not enough virus present in the fluids to isolate or purify, but then they'll say there's hundreds of millions of virus particles inside the fluids of a sick person doesn't make much sense. Virus needs a host in order to replicate, so that's why we use the cell culturing technique. That's nonsense, because what is the human body when sick if not a giant cell culture? Why can't you take the byproduct of that and find the virus inside of it, all right? Fourth one, you're not a virologist. You don't get to determine what isolation is. I mean, I'm a dude looking like I'm going to come up here and do a hip-hop dance routine. So like, I get that, but it doesn't matter because your credentials are irrelevant if you are not presenting evidence that adheres to the scientific method. I don't care what your credentials are. That's an appeal to authority. Evidence is evidence. And if you don't adhere to the scientific method, you're making scientific claims, and then you're weaponizing that amongst the entire human population, I don't care. You need to produce evidence to back your claim. Okay, other components of culture media. So these are some of the things that are added, and I want to emphasize to them. So this is a study that was sent to me by a friend of mine, essentially showing that amphotericin B, which is contained within viral transport media, and it's also contained within within the cell culturing process itself, right? Amphotericin B is added because it is an antimycotic that is said to keep the culture free of fungi, essentially. But the problem with that is, amphotericin B, I want someone to Google this to fact check me, actually. If you type in amphotericin B toxic kidneys as keywords on Google, you'll find a number of articles that identify how amphotericin B is known to be toxic to kidneys. And let's think about this. They're adding amphotericin B onto a monkey kidney cell. That is what the cell culture they're adding it to, and is known to be toxic to kidneys. And they're assuming that this has no impact on the culture itself, is not toxic to the culture, that it's just there to keep the culture free of fungi. Does that make any sense, right? This one, gentamicin. Our data reveals that gentamicin has a significant cytotoxic and adverse effect on the cell viability. Again, they're adding gentamicin to the culture too. They're saying that it keeps this culture free of bacteria, but it has an adverse effect on cell viability. And you can also Google gentamicin toxic kidneys as keywords. Maybe we shouldn't use Google. I shouldn't promote that here, right? So what, Brave browser, DuckDuckGo, whatever, send a, yeah, whatever you want to do. But gentamicin is known to be toxic to kidneys as well. So this brings me to the limitations of electron microscopy as it, itself. So all of these images to the right are said to be images of culture post-cytopathic effect. And those, and a lot of the image, or each one of these images is said to be images of SARS-CoV-2. The problem with electron microscopy is this, and this is by a biologist by the name of Harold Hillman. When a tissue is prepared for electron microscopy, animals killed, the tissue is excised, it is fixed, frozen, embedded, sectioned, rehydrated, stained, mounted, radiated by light, or bombarded by electron beams. If I were to take you in your natural state and do that same thing to you, do you think you'd look like you did in your natural state? Probably not, right? Okay. So we don't know that what we're seeing in these images are just artifacts of the preparation process for electron microscopy. We don't know that the process for preparation for electron microscopy produces things that make the natural morphological appearance of something completely altered. We have no clue. And that's without even going into detail of everything that I just detailed on all of those substances that are mixed with all the assumptions in that process. And that's the problem with electron microscopy, is we have plenty of studies just like this. This study was published in Kidney 360. We have observed morphologically indistinguishable inclusions within podocytes and tubular epithelial cells, both in patients negative for coronavirus 2019, as well as in renal biopsies from the pre-COVID-19 era, meaning that they are finding identical particles to what virologists are calling SARS-CoV-2 in these electron micrograph images, but these are in people who are negative for COVID and also in people prior to the COVID-19 era, right? And we have plenty of examples. How am I doing on time, John? Just so I know. You guys trying to cut me off already? 20? Okay, good. Okay. So we have plenty of studies just like this. This one, again, demonstrates coronavirus. They thought that this demonstrated coronaviruses, but the structures described as viruses are actually clathrin-coated vesicles. But they are virtually indistinguishable from what virologists are calling SARS-CoV-2. Same with this study. Most of the published images depicting the suspected virus are very similar, if not identical, to multivesicular bodies. This one, same thing. This one, the structures identified as SARS-CoV-2 virions look exactly like clathrin-coated pits or vesicles. Now, I always like to bring up this slide, and I got to give credit where credit is due. There's a website you need to go to called virology.com. So not virology, but virology, virology.com. That's my friend Mike Stone, and he has some brilliant takedowns of virology, and he compiled these for another presentation that we did, and he's allowed me to use them. So this one he created, showing this is said to be virus OC43, this is said to be MHV, this is said to be IBV, SARS-CoV-2 virion, extracellular vesicle, exosome. They are all virtually identical particles. They're literally just doing what we like to call the point and declare method. After they do all those things, make all those assumptions, already have a predetermined result made up in their mind, then they point to the particles on these electron micrograph images and say, ah, that's SARS-CoV-2. It's called the point and declare method. It's science. Okay, so this brings me to the other piece. And this is where science as a body can be self-refuting in a way, because formal science is a branch of science, but it is the study of formal systems such as those under the branches of logic and mathematics, which uses an a priori, which is like inductive or reductive reasoning, as opposed to empirical methodology. And why it's self-refuting is because, referring back to the definition of pseudoscience, anything that is claiming to be scientific but does not adhere to the scientific method is fundamentally pseudoscience. Formal sciences as a branch, and also social sciences, don't use the scientific method, so you could kind of argue that they're pseudoscientific, but that isn't to say that logic and math and reason are bad things, right? And I'm going to show how virology also doesn't adhere to logic. What isn't logic? Logical fallacies 101. Welcome to class. What is a logical fallacy? A failure in reasoning which renders an argument invalid, or two, a flawed, deceptive, or false argument that can be proven wrong with reasoning. So this one is probably the most prevalent one. In an appeal to authority, the arguer claims a perceived authority figure's position to either support a claim or to support the entirety of the argument. Robert Malone is a vaccinologist, and he says the virus has been isolated, so you're wrong. That's called an appeal to authority. That's not evidence. Bandwagon fallacy. Overwhelming majority of experts believe the virus has been isolated. Doesn't matter what the overwhelming majority of experts believe. I mean, this is a two-for-one because it's also an appeal to authority. Burden of proof reversal fallacy. This one's really common too. Well, where's your proof that viruses don't exist? The burden of proof lies on those making the positive claim. The positive claim is viruses exist and they cause disease. This would be akin to saying, well, where's your proof that unicorns don't exist? Where's your proof that Santa Claus doesn't exist? Where's your proof that a garden gnome doesn't exist? The burden of proof lies on those making the positive claim. For those of us who are falsifying their positive claims and saying that they don't have any evidence for their positive claims, we are not required to provide evidence. begging the question, this comes from my good friend, Dr. Andy Kaufman. And virology is rampant with this. And I would say science, like all health sciences, are really rampant with this. Essentially, a begging the question fallacy occurs when you, when the conclusion is assumed in one of the premises, right? So in this, they say that a virus is present in the patient. They say viruses cause cytopathic effect. They then do what I just described, where they take that fluid that they assume, but never verify, assume contains the virus, add it to a foreign cell culture alongside all these other things. They observe a cytopathic effect, or the cell breaking down to a bunch of fragments. And then they'll say, ah, the cytopathic effect was caused by viruses that were inside of this patient. That's called circular reasoning. Framing the consequent. So in order to say, this kind of goes back to the scientific method, in order to say that X causes Y, you need to directly observe X causing Y, right? Very simple logic. So if you point to Y occurring and say, ah, that's proof of X, without first establishing that X exists and that it causes Y, that's what's called an affirming the consequent logical fallacy. It's like if you go outside and you see water on your car, you say, ah, that's proof that it rained. But then you look around and there's not water on everyone else's car. Water present isn't proof of rain, right? You first need to establish that it rained, and then you can point to the water and be like, here, here's an example of that it rained. It's very clear, right? Reification fallacy. Assigning any characteristics whatsoever to something that is fundamentally abstract. So saying that a virus mutates, saying that a virus does anything, saying that a virus causes disease, assigning any characteristics or attributes to viruses without first establishing that they exist and they're an actual thing is what's known as a reification fallacy. I want to go back to the ping pong ball brick wall analogy real quick. Do you guys get where I was getting at with that? Okay. I can skip over that then. Okay. So if not a virus, what's making us sick? I had a video that went pretty viral where I rattled all these off. I think that's the only real virus, right? And I think it's just a ridiculous question. And even a lot of people amongst the alternative health freedom, truth-seeking crowd be like, well, dude, I was sicker than I ever was. Like, you're telling me that there isn't any virus. Again, that's an affirming consequent logical fallacy pointing to I was sicker than I ever was as evidence of a virus. But there are so many other things in our environment that are causing us to be sick. And we're so myopically focused on the idea, the unproven idea of these submicroscopic pathic particles that are passed from person to person, that we completely ignore all of these things that are causing us to be sick. And I've highlighted perpetual fear going back to that study. My good friend Eric Coppolino has this presentation that he gives called COVID as a Digital Phenomenon. And he thinks they attempted to do the exact same thing with COVID during HIV. And of course, the HIV/AIDS thing, there's a huge dissident movement called the Perth Group, comprised of scientists from around the world, saying that there's no proof of the existence of HIV and there's no proof that HIV causes AIDS. But the reason that HIV/AIDS didn't explode like this phenomenon did is because COVID is fundamentally a digital phenomenon. And what that means is that because we are so connected digitally and everyone's glued to their phones, we are more subject to fear and anxiety and being manipulated to believe what's happening on these black boxes over believing our own observed reality that we are experiencing ourselves. Okay, and then after I show that list, people are like, yeah, but man, I've been sick. Like, there's one time where I wasn't sick at all, and then I was around someone else, and I had to have something passed from them. And I don't deny that that is an experience that people have where they get sick in the same space as others, and I'll get to my ideas on that. But when we're asserting that it was because we were around someone and they passed something physical to us, again, there's no proof in science of that either. Going back to the Rosenau experiments conducted during the Spanish flu, which is said to be the most deadly pandemic in history, and yes, a lot of people died, but was it caused by something being passed from person to person physically? So in this experiment, they took 100 volunteers and exposed them via various methods to fluids from a sick person. They injected blood from Spanish flu patients into healthy people. They had took swabs from their throats and swabbed it in the back of the healthy patient's throat. They had healthy patients go into a Spanish flu ward and shake hands with several of the patients, have them open mouth cough in their face. Can you guess how many people became sick as a result of this experiment? You know your stuff. You keep on like, oh, you're like mouthing what I'm saying. Zero. None of the volunteers in the experiments developed influenza. And Milton Rosenau is quoted as saying, "We entered the outbreak with a notion that we knew the cause of the disease and were quite sure we knew how it was transmitted from person to person. Perhaps if we have learned anything, it is that we are not quite sure what we know about the disease." And there are several other examples too. This one, 0 out of 50 men became sick. This one, 0 out of 6 men contracted influenza in any of the 3 studies. This one, going back to belief, a higher percentage of people got sick after being exposed to the saline placebo compared to those being exposed to the, quote, virus, right? This one, 0 out of 45. This one, 0 out of 100. This one, 0 out of 200. I could go on and on and on. And yes, there are studies claiming to have shown pathogenicity of certain things, but they typically go like this. They'll take a rat that was raised in an environment where it's in a perpetual state of fear because it's a lab rat exposed to various experiments, not eating a diet that a rat is supposed to eat, not living in the way rats are supposed to eat. And then they will take fluids from a sick person and pump the rat's stomach full of those fluids and be like, ah, see, this is proof that viruses exist and cause disease, or this is proof of bacteria's pathogenicity. In no way is that natural. That's not a natural way to try to prove cause and effect or prove the existence or pathogenicity of something. And anytime they've done it via natural means, they were unable to replicate that phenomenon. So the appearance of contagion, most likely what's occurring is people are exposed to similar toxins, similar eating habits, shared emotional trauma, fear slash belief, shared exposure to non-native EMFs. And I get a little bit frustrated with people in what I like to call the terrain camp who think like me, who just replace the virus, realize that that's not a real thing, and they say, oh, it was 5G causing this. Yes, 5G is a known toxin in our environment. Yes, I think millimeter wave technology is harmful to human health. Yes, I think there are limited studies indicating that 5G and millimeter wave technology is safe. But the way human beings work is we are complex physical, emotional, chemical, spiritual, electric, biological entities with multiple inputs and outputs in our day-to-day lives. So it's usually not as simple as this one single thing caused someone to be sick. We're complex. But there are other possibilities. If I were to yawn right now, a few of you would yawn. Is that caused by a virus? No. When women are around each other for extended periods of time, there's been several cases where they sync up on their menstrual cycles. Is that caused by a virus? No. There's limited studies indicating that trees not only communicate via the mycelium network below the soil, but they also communicate via pheromones, right? So this brings me to the next piece of my presentation. Who's familiar with Veda Austin? By show of hands. Oh, a lot more. This whole room should have their hands up. Her work is incredible. Who's familiar with Dr. Emoto and his work with water? Okay, more people. Veda, okay, essentially what Veda is doing is taking Dr. Emoto's work and expanding on it. She is essentially showing that water can retain memory and water can reflect back to us our environment, and that water has its own communication mechanism, which she calls hydroglyphs. And what's amazing about Veda's work is she is teaching it in workshops all the time to other people, and they're repeating her experiments all over the world. And the way it works is Veda will take water in a petri dish, expose it to a thought, a feeling, a frequency, a written word, a song, set it next to her bedtime, and set the intention for water to show her what she was dreaming. And then when she freezes water, water will reflect back its own artistic interpretation of what it was just exposed to. So I put some examples, and these aren't even the best ones. I highly recommend checking out her website, vedaaustin.com. This is a written number 4, and this was water's response. A picture of a braid, water's response. Photo of one of her friends, water's response. You see their profile image. And she has, I think, over 30,000 examples of this. And she's documented, I think, over 60 hydroglyphs, which it means that she has shown water, let's say, the written word gratitude, or she's feeling gratitude, or a song that represents gratitude. And water will always reflect back, when frozen, the exact same image, its own image for the energy of gratitude, right? So Veda did an experiment. She spoke at my former organization, Health Freedom for Humanity, our California chapter's event in Fillmore, California. And she took a free-range chicken egg or a box of free-range chicken eggs from that farm, cracked them open, froze the albumin. And when she froze the albumin, the crystallography of the frozen albumin in the Petri dish looked like the middle picture, this very beautiful crystallography. And when she takes caged eggs and does the same thing, you see the image on the left, that's what it looks like. And that's representing an egg coming from an environment where it's pumped full of hormones, antibiotics, vaccinated, not eating a diet that a chicken is supposed to eat. And that's what the caged egg looks like. She then set a free-range egg next to a caged egg for a period of time, cracked them open and froze the albumin. And the image on the far right is the crystallography of a caged egg after being next to a free-range egg. So to ensure that this wasn't a fluke, she repeated the same experiment again. She took one free-range egg, surrounded it with 10 caged eggs, set another caged egg to the side as a control, and when she cracked them open and froze the albumin, this was the result. From left to right, top to bottom, those are the caged eggs and their albumin when frozen after being in proximity to the free-range egg. All 10 of the caged eggs now had a more coherent structure. The free-range egg itself was unimpacted. The caged egg in the bottom right quarter that she set to the side as the control still had no coherence, no crystallography. Pretty amazing, right? So again, I have to preface this by saying there are so much more studies that needs to be done on this, because I've had people critique me saying, oh, you're making an assertive claim that you think you know what is a cause of contagion. I don't know, and we still need to study what is the cause of this phenomenon. And again, I go back to this slide. It's probably these things, right? The things that we already know are making us sick. But then these other things like this, we still need to do experimentation on it. So knowing that we are made up of 2/3 water by weight, over 9 out of 10 molecules in our body are water, and the water in our body is structured water, which is why when we cut ourselves, we're not like pouring out water. It's because it's coherent, structured water. And per Veda's work and the work of Gerald Pollack, structured water is able to retain and transmit information much more easily. So knowing that we are made of structured water, what makes us think that we're any different than what's happening with those eggs? When I am sick, right, the water in my body heats up to become less viscous so that it's able to flow more easily, which is why I cough. I throw up, I have diarrhea. That water is trying to get out of my body. And the water in my body is likely to communicate with the water in your body through bioresonance, per Veda's work and the work of so many other people. And if you are in need of detoxification, you are likely to detoxify as well. And that brings me to ask, are symptoms bad? Are they something to fear? Or is our body simply doing exactly what it was designed to do? And that's the problem with not only pharmaceuticals, but a lot of so-called alternative approaches to health. We're just trying to mask the symptoms rather than getting to the root cause. And when we're masking the symptoms, we are inhibiting our body from doing what it was designed to do, to detoxify, which is why so many of us are struggling with chronic disease. And not only that, when we are just addressing vaccines, we are also only addressing the symptoms. Vaccines are just the symptom for the greater problem, which is the pseudoscience of virology. And if we don't get to the root, we will be subject to this again. The same thing that happened with COVID. If we don't get to the root, everything that has happened over the last 2.5 years and beyond is based in the unproven idea that these submicroscopic particles are passed from person to person. And some people are only focusing on the surface level things, again, just addressing the symptoms. And we're playing on their playing field. They have no proof for any of these claims at the core. And these claims are being weaponized amongst all of us. In order to defeat this, we need to get back to the understanding that symptoms are not bad. They're not something to fear. Our body's doing what it's designed to do. And there's no proof of these submicroscopic pathogenic particles that are passed from person to person. All right, that's it. I don't know if I have any time for questions or anything like that. If you'd like more on me, my website is thewayforward.com, and it's spelled FWRD. It's at the bottom. Yeah, thank you so much. Appreciate
it. Thanks, Alex. Yeah. Good stuff. Thank you so much. Give it up for Alex.
Are you sick of being told you will own nothing and be happy?
Are you sick of being told how to live your life by the mainstream media?
Exactly what people think, and this is extremely dangerous to our democracy.
Are you exhausted with the truth community, focusing only on the problems?
Are you ready to do something about it?
Let's take action together. Join the Freedom Cell Network in January 2023 as we return with the Greater Reset for co-creation.
The Greater Reset is a five-day in-person and online gathering where solutions-focused speakers and organizations share practical steps for individual and collective liberation.
This year, we'll even hear experiences from real communities on the ground across multiple continents.
The Greater Reset 4 will focus on activating five focus areas over 5 days.
January 18th, liberate your mind, body, and soul.
January 19th, permaculture and food independence.
January 20th, agorism and parallel networks.
January 21st, take back our tech.
January 22nd, building free and conscious communities.
This is our time to co-create the world we want for 2030 and beyond.
Join us as we lay the foundation for the next stage of a free humanity.
Join us from January 18th to the 22nd, 2023, as we gather online, in person in Central Texas and Morelia, Mexico.
Join us for the Greater Reset 4, co-creation.
View the full speakers list and organize your local activation hub at thegreaterreset.org.